I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. State governments aren't known for transparency or expediency, but Kansas is particularly bad. An investigation by the Kansas City Star lays out the case that officials in Topeka slow-walk public disclosure requests or flat-out deny them at nearly every opportunity. Today, we'll dig into the accusations that have some calling Kansas the dark state. Then, after the holiday traditions, the New Year's ushers in an uptick in divorce. For families with children, the situation can be particularly tough. We'll ask psychologist Wes Crenshaw how a co-parenting approach can help the kids of divorcing parents. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. Divorce is never easy, but there are ways parents can be more sensitive to their children's needs during such a difficult time. Psychologist Wes Crenshaw joins us to talk about strategies that separating couples can use to prioritize their children. But first, the lack of transparency in the Kansas State House is not a new complaint. Just ask anyone who has spent significant time in Topeka. They'll tell you that getting information out of state officials and lawmakers can be a frustrating process. But a lengthy new series of investigative reports by the Kansas City Star sheds light on the human costs of such secrecy. The newspaper's Secret Kansas series details a growing list of concerns about openness in Topeka and recriminations for those who speak out. Much of the responsibility is put at the feet of Governor Sam Brownback. We have several guests here joining us to talk about this. First, Laura Bauer and Judy Thomas. They are on the team of Star reporters who worked on this series. Good morning to both of you, and thanks for coming over.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Also, KCUR's Jim McLean. He's been a State House reporter in Topeka for years. Jim, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve.
And also John Rubin. He's a former Republican state lawmaker from Shawnee. And John, good morning to you as well.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for inviting me.
Judy, first question to you. The Star series says Kansas's government is one of the least transparent in the nation. Just tell us a few of the things the paper's investigation turned up here that led you guys to that conclusion.
Well, one of the things that started all of this was Laura Bauer's been covering child welfare for years, and she can probably address that issue much clearer than I can.
Yeah.
So she's been covering that, came across a lot of really disturbing things as far as not releasing records when children die. And that's kind of what led to this whole thing. We were sitting around talking about some of the other issues that are going on as far as transparency. And we came up with quite a few other ideas involving CanCare, not releasing records or making people sign blank forms when people with disabled children try to for sorry, I'm too excited talking about this. So CanCare was one of the issues. And then we started talking about the legislature and anonymous bills. More than 90% of bills that become law in the last 10 years have been no names, no sponsors
now,
identified.
That surprised me, Laura Bauer. I had no idea, as someone who's worked in the State House, that the system has morphed to the point where you don't know who's signing off on bills.
Right. And when we were talking about it, I had no clue. I'm not a political legislative person. And I'm like, what do you mean, more than 90%? This last session, it was 94%.
Mm-hmm.
And so you look at that and you're like, well, how do I know who did an education bill? How do I know who did a child welfare bill?
Yeah.
You don't know the motives behind it. You don't know why they did it. You don't know if a lobbyist wrote it. And so reporters have been dealing with this for years. Decades. And, you know, when we were talking to you about it, it's kind of you looked at us at one point like we have five heads. Like, that's
right.
Just how Kansas is. You put it together block by block, and it is a quilt of secrecy, and that's what we found. And so any other state can have one of these areas that's just as secret as Kansas. But you put 12, 15, 16,
yeah.
And you're like, why so secret, Kansas? Is, you know, what the question we're asking. And the last couple of days, just since yesterday, we're getting emails, calls from people. Well, where do you hear my story? Where do you hear this? It's healthcare. It's money. It's local government. Another
yeah.
thing we're looking at.
Yeah.
And, you know, the child thing is really the impetus for all of this, because we were trying to get records about
Adrian
Jones. And you
couldn't get them.
We couldn't get them. And what people don't realize is since 2004, when David Atkins, Senator David Atkins, tried to do a disclosure law to say this stuff has to be open, since then, from 2004 to 2015, 105 children have died in child abuse and neglect.
And that bill failed, you're talking about, that Senator Atkins then
It went through, but it was a compromise. Mm-hmm. And the compromise was affected individuals are notified and they can petition the judge. 9 times out of 10, when they petition the judge, that information is secret.
What David Atkins wanted to see happen didn't happen.
Didn't happen. Judy and I talked to him a few years ago when we looked at the Missouri system. Very interesting with the Missouri system with child welfare. Their law is not as transparent as ours on paper. And their law says the director of social services, it's all up to him.
Yeah.
If he wants the information released, and he always releases it. It's very interesting.
You know, Jim McLean, you and I were covering the State House back in the late 80s and early 90s, and I don't remember it being this secretive in those days. What's happened?
Well, a lot of things have happened, Steve. And first of all, I want to congratulate Laura and Judy on what I think has been some really excellent reporting. But also, you know, I want to go back to 2015. Celia Lopez-Jepson, who's one of our colleagues now at KCUR in the Kansas News Service, when she was working for the Capital Journal, did a story on this anonymous bill phenomenon. And she tracked this thing over decades, and it's steadily gotten worse. And we know, Steve, a lot of the bills that are introduced in the legislature are committee, quote-unquote, committee bills. But if you've ever sat through a committee hearing, those bills get introduced literally as a formality to members of the committee with very few questions asked. The public and the media are left then to wonder, where did this bill come from? Hmm. So I think that's one of the things. The other thing is the rise of organizations such as ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. They literally write model legislation and ship it out to their members and legislatures across the country. And oftentimes those bills get introduced as committee bills at the request of one member or another. But again, nobody really knows the origin of those bills. So I think it's been a steady march towards this level of secrecy when it comes to the legislature. And, you know, John Rubin's on the phone as well and a part of this conversation. You know, he was really in the vanguard of trying to open up some of this stuff when he was serving in the Kansas House and crossed paths with leadership and paid a price for it by being taken off of some of his committee assignments. And so he can tell you, I think, very specifically how this has morphed over the last several years.
John Rubin, tell us about that. Again, you're a former Republican lawmaker from Shawnee. What happened to you when you tried to open things up?
Well, it started with two subjects. Let me say, by way of introduction, I also want to add my congratulations to Laura and to Judy and their collaborators on an excellent investigative piece that's continuing to run in the Star this week. And thank you, Jim, for your words as well. I'll just start by saying very briefly that, you know, no less a foundational building block of our country than the Declaration of Independence says that governments derive their just power from the consent of the governed. To me, that consent is meaningless unless it's informed consent. And how can the governed provide their informed consent for government if they are kept in the dark by their government and kept uninformed? To me, the presumption should always be in favor of full transparency and accountability to the public and to taxpayers, and that should be the default, and it should be the government that has the burden of establishing in all the areas that we're talking about, establishing a valid reason, and there are some very limited reasons that I recognize, a valid reason for needing to keep something sealed or redacted and not available to the public. So that's where I start from. Two things got me involved. I joined the legislature in 2011, and I was surprised early on by practices in the legislature that I thought were highly secretive and were designed to shield legislators from their constituents' awareness of positions they were taking on bills and how they voted. It reflected itself, as you've heard, in these anonymous bills introduced by committees. And in that regard, the step I tried to take as chairman of the Corrections and Juvenile Justice Committee when I served on that committee was to require in my committee that any bill introduction be identified in the minutes by the party that introduced it.
And your committee revolted at that, John.
Yeah, there absolutely was a revolt at that. That and a requirement that I tried to institute in the committee that all committee votes be recorded, which are not and virtually every committee in the Kansas legislature, votes are not recorded unless the individual member asks that their vote be recorded in the minutes. So on both of those subjects, I tried to change things in my committee, and there were a number of my committee members, Democrats and Republicans, that objected quite strongly. They were in open revolt on it. They went to the Speaker, and they asked to be. They asked if I had that power. The Speaker said, yes, I did. And they said, well, they asked them to be removed from my committee.
Wow.
I had to have a functioning committee, so I backed off on both of those measures. I insisted all my votes in committee be recorded, in all of my committees recorded, and there were two or three others on my committee that did as well.
John, let me just jump in here. Laura, sometimes I think transparency can sound a little abstract to people or can sound like a concern for journalists and really nobody else, but your stories reveal some real human costs here. Can you tell us a story or two that this series highlights of Kansans who have been affected by this kind of secrecy?
One of the main ones is the gentleman who now lives in Texas, whose son Caleb was killed in 2014. And he was stabbed to death by his mother in the middle of the night. And
mother who had serious psychological issues.
Yes,
yeah.
Who bipolar, not medicated, and just had shown many issues. The dad had hotlined. The hospital had hotlined. There was concern at school. I mean, there was concern for 2 years before his death that there was issues there. And even police would say, you know, she's not all there. There's trouble here. And there was a hotline call a few days before when the mom had drummed up some accusations against dad. And if they had gone to the house then, they would have noticed that there were bogus scripture written in permanent marker all over the walls. There were horns on the pictures. Make a long story short, when he reported to them in May of 2014 that there were issues, a few days later he got an unsubstantiated letter that we didn't find anything to these accusations. Mm-hmm. A couple days after his death, and by the way, his little sister was in the home when he was stabbed to death and was there and could hear everything and see everything. And 2 days after his death, before the dad had given him a memorial service, before he had seen his body, a DCF social worker showed up at his door and wanted him to sign a gag order saying he wouldn't talk about the case.
We have some sound from that from the Star's website that talks about exactly what Laura Bauer just mentioned. Let's listen to that.
So this is what we have to follow. So we have to change this, okay?
So now it's, I can't speak at all.
Basically, yes. If you're telling the media, what does that really do?
Well, it opens the eyes of the public to let them know that there is a problem here, that this family has been let down and a life has been lost because of it.
And I just think, just sit back a little bit, and just hold off on the media until this court order is lifted, I think you'll be better off. Okay? She'll be better off.
I think you'll be better off if I do.
She's really pushing him, the DCF worker, the social worker, trying to get this dad of the deceased son to sign this order.
I mean, some would listen to that and say it was badgering, mm-hmm. that it was very persistent. And this man is a veteran. He fought for the rights for him to be able to say what he wants to say when he says it. And he knew that his son's death could not be without purpose, as he points
out. And the concern here is that it's difficult for the public to gauge the effectiveness of state agencies responsible for looking after troubled, endangered kids.
And in this case, what our sources are telling us is that the state of Kansas, DCF, refuses to take, in a cliche way, a hard look in the mirror of what their practices are and what they have done with families. And when you do not do that, when you do not look at yourself and say, this is what went wrong in this case, this is what went wrong in that case, then how do you improve? Missouri, this happened in Missouri in 2002 when Dominic James died. To the credit of Missouri, what they did is they overhauled that system, they changed the name, they fired top officials, and the system is safer for kids in Missouri. But what did they do? They had Steve Rowling from Kansas City come in and say, this is what is wrong. Bob Holden, the governor, stood up and said, this is a problem. We the prosecutors in that county wanted the paper to get that information. So everybody worked together. You're not seeing that in Kansas. It is a shield, protect ourselves.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about a new series in the Kansas City Star that talks about how closed Kansas is when it comes to openness and transparency about governmental processes. We're visiting with Laura Bauer and Judy Thomas, the two co-authors of this series. KCUR's Jim McLean's also on the phone, who's covered the State House for many years, and John Rubin, a former Republican state lawmaker from Shawnee. Judy, you too also point out the practice of officials using private email accounts to communicate about state business, and this is a way for them to shield their decision-making about open records requests. You know, I've heard about this practice taking place in Washington when the Obama administration, the Trump administration. I'm wondering how big an issue this is all across the country.
It probably is all across the country, and that's one of the points that we made in the story, is that some of these things are going on everywhere, but when you put them all together in Kansas, that, yes, it is an issue. One of the other things that I'd like to add about the whole legislative process is, as we were looking at this, some of the stuff goes back decades. People say it's a lot worse under the Brownback administration. It's gotten worse. But you and I were there back in, and I think Jim probably was too, back in 1990, mm-hmm. when the first gut-and-go bill legislation
took place. Explain to people what a gut-and-go is.
Well, that is when Jim's
John
laughing.
Rubin, John and Jim are laughing here, yeah.
What happened back then is it's when they take a bill that's already passed one house, or not every time, but usually it's passed one house, and it's usually an innocuous bill. It doesn't mean a lot to a lot of people, but it does to some. They strip the contents of that, and then they insert a whole totally different bill that hasn't been doing very well in committee, and they put that in there, and then they pass it, and that's how they get some of this legislation passed.
It's a way to take maybe a relatively unpopular idea and give
it
new life here.
Exactly. Yeah. And what happened in 1990 was Representative Artie Lucas had an abortion bill. It was for parental notification, and it wasn't going anywhere, and so the House Fed and State Affairs Committee had hearings on that, and on, I think, Governor Hayden had his own version of the bill, and they rejected both of those. So Artie Lucas took it up he talked to some of the other members of the committee. They had it all strategically planned, and during a Transportation Committee hearing on, they were working a vehicle registration bill, stripped that out, put in the parental notification bill, passed it out on a voice vote. And so we think that was probably the first one that ever happened. And now, since then, it's kind of standard operating procedure.
I was going to say, Jim McLean, how standard is the gut-and-go procedure in Topeka these days?
Well, I think it's gotten very standard, and John can tell you this has gotten worse. And when you get to the very end of the session and you're dealing with something called a conference committee report, which is a lot of different pieces of legislation, you know, lumped together in one report and brought to the floor in the final hours of the session, so literally they can conclude their business and get out of town. It used to be, as Judy said, that a bill had to at least pass one house or another to even be considered for a gut-and-go or to be lumped into a conference committee report. What John can tell you now is that process is now devolved to the point where it doesn't have to have passed anywhere to get stuck into a bill at the very end of the session and pushed out in a conference committee report. So we continue to see a degradation, I think, of the legislative rules that frankly promote transparency. And what legislators will tell you is the rules that are in place now allow them to operate more efficiently. That may be true, but it also allows them to operate in secrecy.
John Rubin, what do you make of this practice?
Yeah, that all that has been said is absolutely accurate. The triple threat of legislative secrecy and particularly getting unpopular legislation coupled with more popular legislation to get it passed and to shielding legislators somewhat from the view of their constituents and how they're voting and why. The triple threat is everything that's been identified: lack of individual sponsorship of bills, coupled with gut and goes and bundling, which is the practice that Jim just described in conference committee reports. It leads legislators late in session in particular. You hear this quite often. What the heck are we voting on? It seasoned hands, reporters, lobbyists, and legislators themselves often have a difficult time finding out at the last minute in a bundled conference committee report exactly even what's in it that they are voting on. The particular problem with bundling, and I'll just take a second on that, is lumped together in one conference committee report or 6 or 8 or 10. I got the rules changed to limit it to 5 in most cases, but that's still too many. Bills bundled together on conference committee report, many of which had not been properly vetted in one or in some cases both houses with committee with full committee hearings and testimony. They're bundled together in one package. It's late in session. It might be late at night. Legislators have no idea what's even in the package, all of what's in the package that they are voting on, and they're asked to make one vote up or down on the whole package. There may be 5 things in there that the legislator thinks are good policy for their district or the state, and 5 things they might think are awful, and they have one vote up or down, and it can't be amended.
Hmm.
And to me, that's a terrible way to make public policy.
And Steve,
yeah, Jim.
One of the things that the Star series brought out, and which we haven't touched on yet, is, and you mentioned it in your open, the recrimination that we're seeing these days. And a case in point, the person who obviously the Star talked to, I've also talked to, who lost their job at the Kansas Department of Transportation for simply saying, in relation to an accident in Kansas City on a stretch of roadway that was on the list to be upgraded and fixed, but had to be taken off of that list because of the state's budget problems. This person, who was a spokesperson for the Department of Transportation, said, just stated the obvious, which is we had to take it off the list because of the money problems of the state, and that person was literally fired for stating the obvious to a reporter. And, you know, I have that confirmed from numerous sources, and this person will tell you that that same pattern exists in other state agencies across the state, people being fired, demoted, and censored.
Representative Rubin, you know, so many of us insiders and reporters, we care a lot about this stuff. What's your sense of your constituents and how concerned they are about the issues you've raised in our conversation here this morning and the issues the Star series is now raising on its front page throughout this week? How are people going to react to it?
Well, I have found in my work and in my campaigning in my district, and frankly across the state for other candidates and for other issues, that the public has been, up until now, almost completely unaware of many of these practices, particularly in the legislature,
right?
Unless it has affected them personally in some way. So the first thing is to get the information out to the public, which is what I've tried to do, and certainly what this investigative report in the Star is doing a great job with, of what is going on. I find that once people find out about many of these matters, they are almost without exception, conservative, liberal, Republican, or Democrat, angered and upset by many of these practices, particularly the ones I've talked about in the legislature. I proposed a series of changes to rules. I had some limited success in limiting bundling, as I described, no success in requiring that all votes be recorded in committees and on the House floor. There's even many votes on general orders on the House floor that are not recorded as well, and I've tried to make inroads on those. I find that the public, when they find out that votes, many votes of legislators are not recorded and they can't find out how their representative or senator voted, they are incensed by that.
So, John, you think these stories might, John, you think these stories might have some impact?
I absolutely do. The first thing that needs to be done in order to affect change in a lot of these areas is to get the public fully informed about it. I've tried to do it from my limited podium,
right,
as a state legislator, and now I've retired from the legislature as well. But something like the Star will be much more helpful, and I know is also carried in the Wichita Eagle. So as we get the word out across the state, I think the public's going to demand changes in a lot of these areas.
You know, Jim McLean, you're in Topeka, maybe an impossible question here, but can you make a prediction? How do you think lawmakers and leadership are going to respond to these stories as they roll out from Sunday throughout this entire week?
Well, I think that depends, Steve, and I think it's and I think we're starting the process here. The rest of the media is obligated now. These issues have been raised, as you noted at the top of the show, for many, many years. I think we need to really focus on these things more intensely, make sure, as John says, that the public is informed. And as you and I both know, there's a dynamic in politics. If indeed it appears that the public really is concerned about these issues and is demanding change, I think individual legislators will look at it slightly differently. currently entering a campaign season. And as you know, we've had a bit of a dynamic shift within the legislature, and I think that there is a desire for more openness. And John was in the vanguard again in 2015 of what they called the Open Kansas Initiative. It didn't go very far, but the forces are still kind of there in terms of nonprofit advocacy organizations and others who want to see the process of government in Kansas more open. So I think now is a time to push these issues forward now that they've been raised in the Star series and previously in other news reporting, but we just can't drop the ball. We need to keep the spotlight shining on this kind of stuff.
Laura Bauer, just a final point here. What's been the reaction from the Brownback administration?
No reaction. We've heard nothing. We've heard nothing from DCF. We have heard quite a bit from readers, and we are will this afternoon look at many examples that they've sent in for their own stories and secrecy. I think sometimes people think transparency is, oh, reporters are just complaining because they can't get the information. Right. That's not what this is. It's trying to point out to people that transparency can hurt, and it hurts people. And, you know, we have Clint Blancett. We have the spokesperson who lost her job. We have education people who have, you know, fought for bills and only for them to be gutted and not know, and you know, it's hurting people. It's hurting kids. Right. I've had at least two people tell me secrecy is killing our children. But then they're like, I'm like, well, what do you do? And they say, we don't know. And, you know, and that, I guess, for some readers is frustrating because what are they going to do?
Congratulations to Laura Bauer and Judy Thomas for this series in the Star. It runs throughout this week. Thanks for coming in today. Appreciate you both. KCUR's Jim McLean. Jim, thank you.
You bet, Stephen. Well done, Laura, Judy, and the others, Andy Marceau and the others who participated in that good series.
John Rubin, thank you as well. Sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve, and thank you all again.
Time for a break. When we come back, Dr. Wes Crenshaw will join us to talk about how to deal with divorce during this upcoming holiday season. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's show, we found out what it takes to get health insurance through the federal marketplace this year, and we talked about the school options parents have for their kids in Kansas City, Missouri. You can find those conversations at kcur.org. Tomorrow, a conversation with children's author Brian Selznick. We'll talk about his book-turned-movie, Wonderstruck, and we'll look at the impact of war on female soldiers, sailors, Marines, and airmen. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, the holiday season is upon us, and that means gifts and ornaments and holiday gatherings and something else, too. Divorce. Yes, the holiday season traditionally means an uptick in separations and divorce. If that happens, one way to proceed for a lot of families is co-parenting. That can ease a lot of the tension that surrounds the breakup of a marriage. Here to talk about this topic once again is Dr. Wes Crenshaw. He owns Family Psychological Services in Lawrence. He's also an author and speaker on a variety of topics related to family psychology. And you can't work in that world and not deal with divorce and custody issues. And Wes, welcome back. So good to have you here.
Good to be here.
Well, divorce filings start rising early in January, and they hit their peak in March and again in August. Why is that?
Yeah, this is what we call a bimodal distribution.
Bimodal distribution.
Bimodal, isn't that
cool?
There's
a psychological term for you.
You get a peak in March and a peak in August. But what happens is the people, if they don't get their filing done by August, and this is usually the person we call reverently the dumper in the process, the person who knows they want to have the divorce, they get to August and they think, I've just got a whole, you know, get this done right now before the holidays. Mm. Or they get to, say, October and decide, I'm not going to do anything to disturb the holidays. We'll hit it in January. And then there's just a rapidly in upward curve in March, and it hits again in August.
And you can see these
Absolutely.
Things based on the stats, the graphs that show this kind of thing pretty clearly.
Yeah, and in my waiting room, it follows the graph.
So why
closely.
Talk about this now and maybe not in springtime?
Yeah, so as I wish to appeal to those who are considering in their private mind right now divorce, to think about how you want to do this in advance. And it's too easy to just say, oh, I just won't think about this till January, which is why, by the way, We used to believe it just shot up on January 1st, and that's not true. People put it off even thinking about it until January 1st. So while you're thinking about it, think about how to do it right. And if you got kids, as most divorcing couples do, that's where you want to put a lot of your energy. Think about it now.
Mm-hmm. And think about what?
How am I going to do this in a way that is as non-destructive as possible? There's sort of two competing myths. One myth is that, we used to have this idea when you and I were young of the broken home. Mm-hmm. Remember the broken home?
Sure.
And this was really very shameful that, you know, these poor children came out of these broken homes that were marriages ended. That the research is pretty clear on that. That isn't what breaks a home. What breaks a home is a bad divorce. Mm-hmm. So a really dysfunctional marriage is a negative. And a really dysfunctional divorce is an even bigger negative. But a good marriage or a good divorce, kids do pretty well.
Hmm. You've obviously seen hundreds of families in various stages of divorce over the years, Wes. What tends to distinguish a good divorce from an ugly one, at least as far as the kids are concerned? What more can you tell us about that?
Yeah. I was studying with Chloe Madonis, who's one of the old masters of family therapy, and I was asking her that question, and she said, well, just get them to act normal. And I thought initially that seems a little too simple, but it's really good advice.
What does that mean?
It means think of what the generic normal family would be, a family that functions pretty well. There's some cooperation with the parents. The kids have a good relationship with both parents. All the things you think about that you want to have in your home and in mine. And then try to get divorcing people to follow that model. Not normal for them, because as we'll talk about in a minute, that may not be so great. But mm-hmm. to try to think about how can we as divorced parents create a really good family environment, even though we're not married and living together. And that sounds kind of crazy, but it's not.
But that implies a selflessness
right.
that is awfully tough to
yeah.
drudge up when you're going through something as traumatic
yeah.
as a divorce.
Well, that is exactly what the research tells us. And this is why early intervention and really holding on to yourself, how we refer to that, thinking about who do I want to be in this process and who do I not want to be becomes mm-hmm. important. There's a thing called diminished parenting that we find in the literature, and there's several ways it can play out. And diminished parenting means that you get so caught up in your divorce or sometimes your new relationship that you sort of sidestep the whole kid issue. Mm-hmm. And that's one way, or another way is you become fused with the kids. Use them for emotional support. So there's all manner of ways it can go south. But that's why we try to do this kind of intervention to minimize that.
Well, let's talk about some of these obstacles here, because that clearly, I think you've referred to them as the four horsemen,
yeah.
things that really can
yeah.
create havoc as a couple tries to navigate this minefield of a constructive divorce. One of them, the four horsemen are contempt, criticism, stonewalling, and defensiveness. Do you want to take these one at a time and,
sure.
and talk to me about how about with contempt? What is that?
Well, you got to where these come from. It's important to know is John Gottman's excellent research has really become the gold standard for marital therapy. And what you will see in divorces is people take their box of crud and just carry it forward. In the functional divorces, people had a box of crud, all these things may be present, but they're able to see the separation as a way to kind of get rid of all that. And they're better off separate than together, and they honor the other person as a parent. We see that. That's the majority of cases, by the way.
Is that right?
Absolutely. Most divorces are not high conflict.
It's a certain sense of relief, it sounds like,
yeah,
you're describing
exactly.
here.
Yeah. You say, oh, good, I don't have to live with that contemptuous person anymore. I am free. And we see that. Absolutely. Those are the models.
That's the majority.
It is.
I would have bet otherwise, but
yeah.
what do
well,
I know?
Yeah. Because the high conflict divorces and medium conflict divorces are what take up all the court's time.
All the attention.
All the attention.
Yeah, on TV and everything
yeah.
else. Yeah.
And so if you can kind of find a way to bring that to closure, you're always better off. Now, the problem is because there's a dumper and a dumpy. Almost always, the one person feels much more slighted than the other. And there are a number of ways to make the situation worse. For example, having an affair. always creates problems in the separation and in problems in the kids' eyes that are hard to overcome. But there's a long list of those. And all of the bringing forwards from the Gottman literature, what we see in the most difficult divorces, contempt, this is where you see nothing good in the other person. You cannot imagine that they're a bad person.
Right.
Criticizing them, telling, you know, always talking, often to the kids.
That's the second horseman here, criticism.
Yeah, often talking to the kids, but even just in your own head, this bitter attitude about what a bad person the ex is. And it, of course, if you didn't have disputes with the ex, they probably wouldn't be an ex. But to stay dwelling upon that instead of seeing this as, okay, we needed to not be together because we mutually criticize. It just becomes another part of the divorce. The judges love that.
Dr. Wes Crenshaw is in the house. We're talking about constructive ways to go through the process of getting a divorce. If you want to join our conversation here, 816-235-2888. Maybe you've had some experience that you can share that might be helpful to other couples who are contemplating this. 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Two more of the horsemen here, stonewalling and defensiveness, Wes.
Stonewalling, it comes up either in a mechanism to try to avoid the other person or to try to do them passive-aggressive harm. So it's just, it's exactly what it sounds like, blocking communication, refusing to cooperate, not fulfilling custody agreements, et cetera.
Which is another version of contempt, it sounds like.
It's these all exist separately. They've observed them in the research, but they all come from a bitter place or a negative place. And then the defensiveness is where you're always, it's not me, it's you. And I got to tell you, the worst problem with defensiveness, research on marriage is that second marriages fail at a higher rate than first marriages.
Again, that shouldn't be that way.
Do you want to?
In theory, it shouldn't be that way.
Do you want to guess why that's true?
Well, help me. I haven't been through divorce.
I'll give you a hint. Yeah.
I'm crossing my fingers.
Katie's so nice.
Yeah, she is.
Okay, so I'll give you a hint. Third marriages succeed at a higher rate than first and second marriages.
Really?
Yeah. Here is why. People, but
at that point, you figure there's got to be something going on with me.
That's exactly it. Yeah, yeah. That's exactly right. By the eventually, I've seen it happen. I've had clients where they have this, moment of clarity where the second marriage is going right down the same chute, and they're like, "Where have I seen this happen before?" Exactly. So defensiveness is, it's all about you, it's not me. And not only is that damaging in the divorce and custody process, it guarantees you that you're just going to keep getting married forever to different people that have all the same problems. It's weird. How do you find all these people that have all the same problems and you have nothing to do with it?
But then second marriages, though, that they fail more often than the first marriage.
Because people haven't caught on to that.
They haven't figured it out yet. Yeah.
As a therapist, I think most of us who do this work know if you're doing divorce recovery therapy, the first thing you try to do is get people not to just do the same thing again.
Yeah. So. How about anything else here that you would point to? Maybe like narcissism?
Yeah. Never underestimate the unrelenting power of narcissism in these situations. And you actually, if you do testing in these cases, which is only usually a court-related matter, you'll actually see it show up. People, again, defensiveness and not being able to see where you are contributing to the problem, both in the marriage and then in the post-marriage, always figuring out how other people's needs are less important than yours. And as a national conversation, we seem to see a lot of narcissism these days, which probably doesn't help our families.
If our listeners have suggestions on how to go through a divorce in a constructive way, I'd like to hear them. 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Okay, let's turn to Sue, a way to deal with this in a very concrete sort of way, because Wes, you've been working on a form of intervention called co-parenting consultation. That's basically what, a response to these problems we're talking about, right?
Yeah, this is.
And what is that?
Well, the idea is not new. We're just trying to reprocess it. I have a few attorneys that I consult with just over lunch and have some discussion about these things. And nothing has ever worked. I could go through the list, and people who are inside the business will know. But things like domestic case management and conciliation and mediation and all these things, custody evaluation, I've done many of them. These things just tend not to solve the problem. Sometimes I think they make it worse. And what we're trying to do is to get people back, essentially. I don't know that I've ever heard it put this way before, but I've come to realize we're kind of putting them back in marital therapy mm-hmm. without calling it that. And we're trying to deal with some of these problems of contempt and defensiveness and so on. And, of course, the catch is that at least when they were married, there is some pull to try to be decent to each other. It may not be very strong, especially because people wait about 6 years too long to go to marital therapy mm-hmm. before they should have. So you don't still have that, but you've got to try to coalesce around the kids and the parents' love for the children. Now, that gets malignant at times because some people will say, well, because I love my child so much, he shouldn't have to see his mom or dad. Mm-hmm. And they corrupt that. And you have to remind people, is that how you felt about your mom or dad? Mm-hmm. You would just like to not ever see them again. Mm-hmm. Try mm-hmm. to appeal so that people will get into some desire to have a mutually improved co-parenting relationship.
We're talking about constructive divorces with Dr. Wes Crenshaw. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Joanne from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning. I was listening to your show, and I have just recently gone through a collaborative divorce, mm-hmm. and I just wanted to say that a lot of what you're saying, it's exactly right. I was blindsided after 34 years, and after I got over the shell shock, I started to research what's the smoothest way to do this and not bring all the parties, and our kids were adults. And when I looked at collaborative divorces, and there's a lot of articles out there about it, and I looked at what we could do. I basically sent him the information and said, this is what we're going to do. If you want to make this smooth and easy for all our family, let's do that, even though we have hurt feelings and lots of emotions. And it was the best thing. I've told more people, just do it that way so that you're not shooting at each other and bringing all these and stonewalling and everything that you were just talking about. And it definitely worked for us. It's painful no matter what. But this is a way to make it less painful.
Joanne, hang on for just a second, if you would. What is a collaborative divorce? There's another term we're using here, and I'm wondering what that is.
Well, I couldn't have described it better in terms of the emotion and rational impact than Joanne did. So the quick version of this is that you generally have a single attorney, and that person, by the way the ethical and legal codes are set up for attorneys, has to represent one and only one person. However, the other person agrees to be involved in a process with the attorney and the client where they work together to come up with a property plan, settlement, and a parenting plan if there's a need for one. Joanna had adult kids, so there wasn't. And then that person files it. At some point, the non-represented party can seek counsel, but the least expensive and least complex way to do it is to do it the way she's describing. Now, that takes some trust, and it takes on the lawyer who's actually trained in that model, because this is a different way to practice.
You're hiring one attorney instead of two, it sounds like.
Exactly, and that makes it non-adversarial, which seems weird, but people who've seen it work, and she's absolutely right, I've seen it work many times, find that it is the better way to go, particularly for cost.
Joanne, I'm wondering, how did you approach this experience and take out the animosity aspect mm-hmm. of what you were having to go through? I can only imagine how difficult that was.
Well, what you said was true, except to add for one more point, we had a mediator that was an accountant, and that's what the lawyer
that's a good idea.
Had us do, and because of that, it made it more business-like. All we had to do is bring in everything we owned, the paperwork on everything we owned, and we gave it to the CPA accountant. Then they went through, put together the spreadsheet, then we come back for the second meeting, and then we just sit there and saying his, hers, his. And if we didn't know what category it belonged in, it was in the middle column. And it made it so business-like. Now, I cried during it, and I was emotional a little bit, but you just, okay, where does this belong? And you just go through that process. And so he starts it, and then the CPA starts it, and then the lawyer reviews it. And I did have my own lawyer look at what we came up to with, just a quick glance at it, and totally agreed with everything, but just had some one recommendation about a house that needed to be sold, some wording. And it cost us, I know it was like $2,500.
Yeah, that's a textbook perfect example. Yeah.
Well, Joanna, I'm really glad you called in and shared your story. Thanks so much.
And I'm going to add to that, the thing you'd ask is, how did she do this? She described a couple of processes. I'm going to talk about them psychologically. This idea I said earlier of holding on to yourself. Mm-hmm. What Joanna did was experience her emotions, and she didn't hide from them. She didn't deny them. But she also thought, what do I value? What is important to me? Mm-hmm. And certainly saving money is valuable. But also, how do I want to go through this in a way that's as non-destructive as possible? And then she acted on those values. Now, it's that simple and that complicated to get there. But that's a great example.
How often do you come across couples who walk in the door and you sense the tension, you sense the animosity, but how often can you get them to a place where they can have an experience like Joanne just described to us?
It is a lot more than you'd think is a good answer to that. I'm even surprised sometimes. I'll tell you what's hard to detect is which one's going to be successful. I've had cases where they came in maybe at the tail end of a marriage, and really what we did was kind of have a funeral and accept the death of the marriage, and then immediately move into how do we do this in a way that's helpful to everyone. And it's just cooking along, and, you know, I'm doing a victory lap, and it just goes to pieces.
Because
somebody cannot hold on to themselves. Somebody begins to lose the focus of what's really important, and they feel betrayed. I had one person, you know, once reverse themselves and not want to be divorced anymore, and they were the dumper. You just can't predict it. I've had other cases where I thought this is going to be on appeal at the Kansas appellate system, and the people will pull it together and realize in the end, if they work together, it's a lot easier, particularly with kids, to have another co-parent than to send that person to the netherworld and not allow them or try to not allow them to have custody.
Hey, what does insurance cover? What does insurance not cover, Wes? What do you see there?
This is actually an important question because these things can get expensive. With one exception, a co-parenting consultation is not psychotherapy. It's not a diagnosis and treatment of a mental illness. So these are cash-based rates. Now, it's probably cheaper than an attorney and cheaper than mediation, but it is not. And people will try to fudge this and bill it as insurance, and that's kind of not okay.
Right.
The
right.
one exception, and it's a little tricky, is if the child has demonstrable symptoms that are coming from adjustment to the divorce and correction of the parents acting out will help improve the child's symptoms, that's legitimate family therapy to remediate the adjustment disorder. And so that's billable insurance. But there's a lot more complexity to it than that. And in general, I would say it's usually not insurance reimbursable.
So ideally, what would you advise a divorcing couple to seek out and how to proceed? What are you suggesting here?
Well, you've got to – the earlier people get started, the better. Sometimes people enter, like I described, at the tail of the marriage. Sometimes people will enter after they have decided to divorce, either as an individual who's saying – and I really, to their credit, I have people come in who say, I need your help to not screw this up. I'm so upset. I'm going to say a bunch of things I can't take back. Help me. And I really respect that. I'll get a text. Somebody will be, I'm standing outside my ex's house and I need to, you know, it's almost like AA, you know, and you say, you need to leave now. People who are really trying to work themselves through this will enter at that point, or they'll come in with the partner. And then you get people who wait till like the whole 6 years in marriage thing, wait till the court orders them, and the court can order you to co-parenting consultation, and those will work too. But then you are cleaning up perhaps years of messes.
Let's go to some calls again. Tom from Kansas City, Missouri. Tom, good morning.
Hi, great show. I just wanted to say one thing on the insurance. I'm a family systems therapist. I work with marital issues and divorce issues. And there is no other issue that impacts an entire family more than this. I've never once not had an insurance company balk about paying for it, because you just sell it on the idea that you're putting off a whole lot of other problems down the road by doing this civilly at the beginning. I just wanted to add to that.
Tim, are you talking about both sides of the state line or one side of the state line?
No, both sides. The insurance company universally
same companies,
wants to pay for it. So that's the only ad, you know, thing that adds.
I appreciate that, Tom. Yeah, thank you.
Not to get into too much depth on insurance. I think you guys did that Friday. But you have to, in order to bill insurance for anything, you have to have a diagnosis. You have to have a mental health diagnosis, and you have to show medical necessity. What Tom is suggesting is there's medical necessity, which I agree. And for many people, there is a diagnosis, but it gets very tricky when you are in what's really a forensic process. This is kind of where we differ some with the clinicians. I'm trained in forensic psychology, and so this is a court process. And some of the things that we believe you need to do a good co-parenting consultation just fall outside the realm of clinical service.
Can you talk about the distinction and help people understand when is it time to get a mediator? Mm-hmm. When is it time to go through an attorney? And how do you decide that?
Well, the decisional tree is kind of complicated, but I can explain how each differs. And, you know, when you talk about collaborative divorce, that's even a little more complex. Attorney's going to advocate for you and your best interests, and they're going to give you advice about how to go down the path in an adversarial process. Then you have collaborative. We talked about that. Many people get referred for mediation. Interestingly enough, the high conflict people don't succeed in mediation because all a mediator can do is be a neutral. I'm speaking to the mediators conference here in December, and they're limited in their ability to influence the process, and it's a confidential process.
Mm-hmm.
Then the co-parenting consultant isn't bound by that. The understanding and the order is they will give some feedback to the court, perhaps not an opinion, but a fact-based statement of the co-parenting. And then folks can work that out kind of like a mediation, but more with a mental health advisory component.
I was going to say Wes Crenshaw will present a workshop for family law attorneys and mediators on co-parenting consultation at Bethel College in Newton, Kansas. More information on the Kansas Institute for Peace and Conflict Resolution website. We'll have to find out more about that, right?
Yeah, they have a really good conference every year down there. And if people are mediators, many attorneys also are mediators. That's good CE credit from all the people that speak there.
Dr. Wes Crenshaw owns Family Psychological Services in Lawrence. Wes, always good to have you here. Thanks
good
so much.
Good to be here. Take care.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date, and you can follow me at Steve Kraske. On tomorrow's show, children's author turned screenwriter Brian Selznick joins us, and we'll take a look at how war impacts female troops and the people they leave behind back home. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Justin Garnett produced this show. I'm Steve Kraske. And you are up to date.